I'm Richard Rogers, President of the California Fish and Game Commission. Welcome to the continuation of the March meeting from yesterday's initial meeting. Today, for everyone's edification, we're going to be starting with Agenda Item 20, which we announced yesterday afternoon, so do be prepared for that. Sitting immediately to my... I'm from Carpinteria, California. Sitting immediately to my right is Cindy Gustafson from Tahoe City. Vice President of the Commission. Seating immediately to her right is Commissioner Jim Kellogg from Discovery Bay. Over the top of this guy is Commissioner Mike Sutton from Monterey. Sitting immediately adjacent to me is John Carlson, who is Executive Director of the Commission. Sitting on the other side of Commissioner Sutton is Adriana Shea, who is Deputy Executive Director. Our other Deputy Executive Director is John Fisher, who is sitting over there, second line. Deb Barnes, sitting at the end of the table, is our AG, now and forevermore. Bill Cunningham, I think you were, yes. The king is dead, long live the queen. The king is dead, is sitting over there in the audience. We also have Sonke Mastrup, who is deputy director of the department. And next to Sonke is Sherry Cole of our staff, and Sean Cubbage, our award-winning staff, of course. We announced a bit of that yesterday, for those of you who don't know. Sean Cubbage is sitting down at the end. Other department people, we have Neil Manji. Neil, you're here someplace. They're sitting back in the back. Eric Loft is here, I know. Maria Vojkovic, I think, is here. Well, at least she's going to be here. And Chief of Enforcement Nancy Foley is going to make a little announcement. So here she comes.
Good morning, Commissioners. Nancy Foley, Chief Law Enforcement Division. And I have a couple of new people or new positions here today, so I thought I'd bring the people up and introduce them to you. First, we have Captain Roland Takayama. He is a captain out of the Santa Barbara area, but he will be working with a new regulation unit to develop the regulations that we put forward to both the commission and the legislature. So he'll be taken out of his normal role for the most part and deal strictly with regulations and public education and outreach with the lead issue as well. So, Roland.
It's nice to see you, Roland. Roland hails from my neck of the woods.
Yes, it occurs to me. Did you ever get news of the rescheduling of our junior high?
No.
I just flashed that I invited you, and then I didn't tell you what the new schedule was because we had flooding, and I didn't want you to just stay.
Yeah, when they did that to you in high school, they were sending a message.
Yeah. You know. Well, I apologize for not telling you about the new
He
day.
Thought you were taking him to jail.
Yeah.
But, yes, I'm looking forward to this new role, working with people throughout the state, and there are some regulations that have some conflicts, need cleaning up and whatnot, and hopefully I can help facilitate cleaning those up, and we'll be working closely with the commission on that.
Thank you, Roland. It's good to see you.
Next is Warden Lori Oldfather and her canine companion, Louie. And these people were this handling team were just badged 2 days ago, I think, at an award ceremony on Wednesday. This is our first canine team. This is a detection team. So Louie, although he had his belly rubbed most of the day yesterday here at the commission meeting, is trained in detecting quagga, ammunition, cartridges, and abalone right now, and I think I heard Lori say that she was also working on fish. So we'll bring Louie up and Lori.
For those of you who love yellow labs, you're going to fall in love with Louie. He is great.
He doesn't know how to speak yet.
Lori said he doesn't know how to speak yet, so I guess I'll do it for them.
I think his tail is speaking for him.
Yeah, if you bring him over here, he'll get on the TV.
Yeah, bring him over so we can put him on, over here into that corner so we can get him into the broadcast. There's Louie. And we got to show his badge. Look at Louie's badge. Is that great?
Can you zoom in on that for the...
Hey, Steve.
Zoom in on that.
Yeah, we
now we got to show Louie's badge here. There he goes. Hey, Louie. You're on TV, Louie. It is amazing to me, Nancy, that a dog can smell out a quagga mussel. That is just fantastic. And for protecting our resources, I can't think of a better trade.
Well, fortunately for us, we have three teams down at the Fred Hall Show, and we had a little bit of an incident with a lake in Southern California that has some adult mussels in it, and they were going to be moving some boats. So our canine teams are going to be headed to that lake today to go around the boats before they're able to move them. So we're putting them into work, and, you know, with just two days on the job, and they're already at work.
They found them at the show? I'm sorry, would you
no,
say that again?
The dogs are at the show in Southern California. They're all stationed up here, but they're down there. And so it just worked out perfectly that they're down there. We're going to be able to deploy them and see if any of these boats actually have quagga mussels on them before they move.
You probably heard that Casitas Water District shut down Lake Casitas.
As somebody told me that
to all boats, which means all fishing, which is really tough on people down there.
Mm-hmm. This is something that's groundbreaking. I think I may have talked about it before, but these are the first dogs in the world that have been trained on quagga mussels, and I see their importance in California certainly growing immensely.
Well said.
And then Chris Patton was our assistant chief for the Central Enforcement District for, I believe it was like 17 years, and he retired in December. And so we promoted John Baker, who was a captain in the Central Enforcement District, and John's here today as our new assistant chief for the Central Enforcement District.
Welcome, John.
It's always difficult to follow dogs or kids. I know that's a rule, but I'd just like to welcome the commission of the Central District. The Central District spans from Calaveras and San Joaquin County on the north down to Kern County and then out of Highway 58 and up to Inyo and Mono County. So I'll be seeing you again over in Bishop, I believe. But welcome, and thank you for all the work you do. And thank you to the commission staff. I've been calling the commission quite a bit with the new regulations and whatnot, and you guys have been very helpful. So thank you.
Thank you, John. Congratulations on your stars. Yep. Okay. With that, take it away, John.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. To get started this morning, let me make a couple brief announcements. If you're interested in speaking on an agenda item, we have speaker cards on the table out in the hall. Please fill it out to your specific agenda items you'd like to speak to and turn them into staff at the table on the side here. Remember that on specific agenda items, you are limited to speak to that agenda item on your comments. And we have an aggregate total of 10 minutes per day per person spread across the agenda items, so please keep that in mind.
And by that, I might emphasize that what we mean by that is that you stay on the agenda item very specifically. You don't use that as a springboard to talk about something else. Thank you.
Also want to remind everyone today's proceedings are being filmed and live streamed across the internet, and they also are being archived and are available at later dates for free via our website, which links into the AGP video website. So if you have an issue you want to look up later, you can go back and check that out. So as I announced yesterday, the order of today's agenda items are going to be changed a bit, and we are going to start off with number 20, 20A and 20B. If you want to speak on this item, please get your speaker cards in now. We're going to start off with this. And 20A is receipt of public testimony on proposed addition of Section 124, Title 14, California Halibut Trawl Grounds. 20B is request for information, review of information, possible consideration of and possible adoption of findings on halibut trawling pursuant to Fish and Game Code Section 8495. Did the department have some introductory remarks on this? We heard a pretty detailed report last meeting from the department on this issue, and unless there's questions from commissioners, I think we can go straight to public comment.
Well, we've also had considerable public testimony over a number of meetings, so that everyone on the internet understands this issue has been rather thoroughly vetted. But here we go. So go ahead and start with public testimony.
Sankey, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, commissioners, we do have staff Particularly Steve Wirtz here to answer any technical questions. Marcy Remko is here if you have questions about the regulatory process. So we're here ready to answer any questions you might have, but you've received all our testimony.
Yeah, I did see them here. I presume we'd be able to get at them. So. Go ahead. Please come. No, you have to do it on mic and identify yourself.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Steve Wirtz, and I'm a senior biologist on the State Fisheries Evaluation Project, and we do have a short PowerPoint presentation for you, if that's okay.
Now, why would the boss not know that? Okay, yeah, good. Is it teed up?
Yes.
Steve? Fire away. Let's drop the first set of lights, too, please.
Okay, I already introduced myself. At your February meeting, I summarized an informational report that we provided to the Commission on the bottom trawl fishery operating within the California halibut trawl grounds. Following that presentation, the Commission requested that the Department create some seafloor maps that show where hard bottom occurs within particular waters of these trawl grounds. As per the Commission's request, the State Fishery Evaluation Project created a supplemental report, which is part of your briefing materials, and today I will summarize that report for you. It includes information on where hard bottom occurs, provides some summary information on the fishery, and provides some regulatory options for you to review.
Our technical people have been invaded by a virus, so let them work on their little problem here. You don't have a pop-up blocker? You got to stop surfing those websites, Steve.
Quickly, in 2004, the legislature approved Senate Bill 1459, which amended and added sections to Fish and Game Code that pertains to bottom trawl fishing.
Hang on just a second. This is too irritating. Steve, what do you think? Are we clean? Okay. Go ahead. Thank you. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Just as a refresher, as Commissioner Rogers has said, this has been an event that we've been talking about over the last year. It's a result of legislation in 2004 that amended and added code pertaining to bottom trawl fisheries in California. What's important to this agenda item is the authority that was given to the Commission to manage California's bottom trawl fisheries that do not have a state or federal fishery management plan. It created four closures within the California halibut trawl grounds in 2005. And it will implement four additional closures commencing April 1. Bottom trawling is prohibited in state waters except within the California halibut trawl grounds. These grounds were established in 1971. They are located off of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties from Point Aguello down to Point Magoo, in waters not less than one nautical mile from shore. The red lines here shown on the map represent the areas in which you can still bottom trawl in the California trawl grounds. The blue areas shown here, the diagonal lines, and up here on the northwest end of the trawl grounds are the 2005 closures, and they comprise about 13% of the open waters at that time. The black cross hatching shown up here on the northwest and down in the southeast section are the closures proposed for 2008. These closures comprise about 42% of the trawl grounds. The Commission has the authority to reverse the pending closures if they make a determination that bottom trawl gear operating within the California halibut trawl grounds minimizes bycatch, is not likely damaging seafloor, is not adversely affecting the ecosystem, and is not impeding reasonable restoration of kelp, coral, and other biogenic habitats. As per the Commission's request, the Department developed an initial statement of reasons that provides them with options to keep one or more of the proposed area closures open if they make a finding based on Fish and Game Code criteria in 8495. That's the code section. The options include option one, which would keep all four of the proposers' closed areas open. And option two gives the commission the ability to pick ones that they find, one of four or all four, that meet the criteria in Fish and Game Code. Regulatory action will need to take place at the April 11th meeting in Bodega Bay, I believe. If the commission cannot make a finding, then the closures will be implemented commencing April 1, 2008, and there will be no need for regulatory action. Over the next series of slides, I'm going to show you some physical attributes, some fishery performance information for each of the proposed closure areas. This figure here shows closure area A, and in previous, I didn't mention it to you, but these closures from the northwest down to the southeast are labeled A, B, C, and D, and that relates to the regulatory designation in Fish and Game Code. Area A is located on the northwest end of the trawl grounds between 1 and 3 nautical miles between Rocky Point and Point Conception. In this figure, the brown areas represent hard seafloor, and the orange represents historical kelp beds. This four patches of hard bottom comprise about 10% of Area A's surface area. This image is for trawl intensity, and it also shows some fishery performance areas shown in the bottom lower corner of this figure. Trawl log data from 1997 to 2006 was used to create this intensity image. As you can see, the intensity scale bleeds over into waters that are adjacent to the trawl grounds and over areas where there's rocky habitat. And I want to point out the scale ranges from high intensity, blue, medium is green, and yellow is the is nominal intensity. This is an artifact of trawl log data. Trawl fishermen report a straight line, a point to point in their logbook data. So the fishermen may have followed a curve path, especially in an area like this where the coastline is not a straight linear path. And you get results that look as if they're fishing somewhere they probably did not. To adjust for this situation, staff used a geographical information software package to enumerate trawl transects that occurred in cells within a matrix that was laid over the trawl grounds so we could generalize and find out where trawl efforts are occurring. What's important in this figure is seeing the kind of green area here that occurs along here through here. The effort that's shown up here in this 2005 closure occurred prior to that closure being implemented. This habitat is about 90% soft bottom, and on average since 1997 it's generated about $15,000 in ex-vessel revenue. This is for closure B, which is located between Point Conception and Gaviota. It's also located between 1 and 3 nautical miles from shore. The same color scheme applies. The brown represents rocky seafloor. In this particular area, the rocky seafloor comprises about 28% of the ocean bottom in this area. Kelp grows in proximity of the inner boundary, but has never been observed in the California halibut trawl grounds kelp canopy. This is the trawl intensity image for this particular area. Since 1997, it's been nominal. There has not been any trawl effort in this area. It's generated on average $20,000, which is nominal or insignificant. And the soft bottom in this area is about 72% of the area. Both of the previous areas were scanned using side-scan sonar. Area C ranges from Santa Barbara Point to Peters Point, and we just received information from Cal State University, Monterey Bay, and the USGS survey. This data involves not just side scan, but multi-beam sonar, so it's much higher resolution data. This closure is also located between 1 and 2 miles from shore. And we previously thought from just the side scan data it was about 10% rocky bottom, but the new data indicates it's about 3 to 5% rock bottom in this particular closure. This is the trawl intensity image for Area C. You can see where the majority of the effort occurs along here. The yellow, this is very nominal, almost insignificant information where the brown rock patches occur. This area is the second largest of the four, and it's generated over $90,000 in ex-vessel revenue from on average. This next image is for from Wainimi Canyon down to Point Magoo. It's Area D. This was also mapped using multi-beam side-scan sonar technologies, and this information just became available during just the week of our February meeting. The technologies, we know that there's an extensive submarine canyon system around this closure. There's one part of it actually comes into Area D, but this area is essentially 100% soft bottom on these areas not within the canyons. These small patches, we magnified them a little bit so you can see, but it represents less than a fraction of 1% of the bottom. The intensity image for this particular area, it shows where the effort occurs. It occurs along this area here of this closure. It does not occur in the canyon area. This is the smallest of the four closures, but it generates the second highest ex-vessel revenue. In summary, I've taken each attributes of each of the proposed closures and put them in a table for a side-by-side comparison for you. Some of the characteristics or attributes of each of the areas are shown over here on the left. I'll start with Area A. And Area A is the third largest of the four closures. It's about 90% soft bottom habitat, but when you compare trawl intensity, or I mean actually trawl effort, and ex-vessel revenue, it's relatively low compared to C and D. And also when you compare the revenues. Area B is the largest of the four closures. It's about 72% soft bottom, but since 97 it has not received much fishing effort, and that's the ex-vessel revenue is indicative of that fact, $20 on average. Area C is the second largest. It's 97% soft bottom habitat. It has the highest trawl effort in nautical miles towed in the area, and it generates on average since 97, $92,000 in ex-vessel revenue. Area D is the smallest of the four. It is basically 100% soft bottom habitat. It's the amount of effort that occurs in that area is on par with the effort here is on par with C, and it generates $48,000 on average in since 1997. That concludes this summary for you. Unless you have
good.
Any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the Sankey?
I would like to take this opportunity to thank Steve for waking me up.
Any questions from the commissioners? Nope. John, fire away.
Okay, we have several speaker cards, and the president has determined that each person will have up to 3 minutes to speak. There were a couple of individuals who contacted commission staff in advance with have a presentation, and they're going to get up to 9 minutes total, and they will be cut off right then, basically. So summarize that, and that will be using up most of your time for the day across the board. We'll start with April Wakeman, followed by Tom Raftikin, followed by Gary Burke.
We are time sensitive today, so April, I don't mean to be being too strict, but we're going to start. Once you're at the podium, the time clock's going to go.
My name is April Wakeman. I represent United Anglers of Southern California, and the reason I'm speaking is because Dallas Weaver is sick this morning. So what I'm going to do is jump really quickly through his presentation. And yes. Yeah, next.
Okay. Now, may I ask, all the speakers, John has called out the subsequent speakers, and if you do have presentations, let's make sure you tee them up with Steve in the back of the room. Thank you.
F didn't work. Oh, okay. This is Tom's presentation, I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. So this is forward.
Do you want to?
I'll get the other one.
Save a little time.
This is Tom's presentation.
Okay, so we're going to take
you know how this
Mr. Raptigan out of order here.
Okay, forward, back.
Forward, back.
And then you can use,
okay.
Use this. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll just jump in if that works. Tom Raftigan, President of United Anglers of Southern California. This is a presentation that we've tried to do on bycatch, and the first thing I want to say is we've requested information from the Department of Fish and Game and had a really hard time getting the data. We've extracted the information for this presentation from the efforts that came out and were presented to you last month. So. Last month you saw a chart on bycatch, and it looked something like this about bycatch in the California halibut trawl zone versus bycatch in the Federal Limited Entry Central Coast study, and it was like very eye-opening. The explanation, the differences were due to the region's trawl, Federal Limited Entry Central Coast fishery trawls. Were exclusively in federal waters, and the other, obviously, the California halibut trawl ground study was in state waters. And the difference there is the fact that one has got federal bycatch and the other has got state bycatch. So this is just a little bit better labeling on the thing that you saw last month. Okay, let's take a closer look at this. Comparison between two fisheries included only federally managed species. Excluded from the comparison were all state managed species. Was it important? Absolutely, extremely important. This is the definition of bycatch for California. Bycatch is defined as any fish or other marine life that are taken in a fishery but which are not the target of that fishery, and it's the code section. Include discards, alive and dead, and incidentally caught marketable species that are kept and sold. This is the definition that we use in California. Let's take a look when you start adding this. The column on the right was the catch that was included. The catch that was included in last month's visuals, and the column on the left is the stuff that was excluded by the Department of Fish and Game, that they didn't look at it. Let's go further. Let's take a look at what the charts look like when you have add that in. Now, this is the difference between the federally managed study on the left and the state managed in the California halibut trawl zone. A very, very significant difference than the picture that you were presented last month. Discards of ground fish. Page 10 collaborative report on the California halibut trawl ground study states that discards of ground fish in the California halibut trawl zone study was higher than that of the federal study, 74% versus 60%. So what we're looking at here, when you're talking about ground fish discards, they were higher in the California halibut trawl ground study. And again, what we're looking at here, these are the figures. This is right from the information that you were given last month. But let's look at it visually up on the screen. Discards of ground fish. The other thing is, the CHTG study erroneously attributed the higher level of discards because of the prevalence of several large bat rays. And we're taking a little bit of liberty in trying to figure out why that was discovered. Perhaps it was caused by a late change to the study when bat rays were removed from the comparisons being state-managed fish. They changed the percentages. So let's take another look at that ground fish discards. Now, instead of having 64-60, you're looking at really 95% discards, and this is in the California halibut trawl zone. So really what we're saying is that when you seriously look at the pictures and honestly look at what's going on there, we've got a significant bycatch problem in the California halibut trawl zone. Has the industry made their case about minimizing bycatch? When you take a look close at the data, and again, we would like to take a look at all the data because we think even a better picture can be presented on this. But when you take a look at it, it's very clear that the picture that was painted to you visually last month is not actually what's going on there. And then again, let's go down about seafloor habitat. The information provided, you only have anecdotal data which provided relative impacts of natural disturbances. Primary natural disturbances are wave action and stream flows. However, these impacts are limited to depths approximating wave heights in nearby river mouths. Neither condition is applicable to areas slated for closure. What you're saying is the bottom out there is stable. And the thing is, this is not about hard bottom versus soft bottom. The soft bottom is extremely valuable also. And this is not simply about saving hard bottom out there. You go out in the desert and you take a look at the desert and say, my gosh, it's all sand and a few plants. Go out there at night and all of a sudden you see the life on the desert. You don't go out and drag chains across the desert to catch jackrabbits. And that's what's happening in these trawl zones. Will not adversely affect ecosystem health. Industry standard presented no data indicative of this standard, suggesting the bottom habitat is akin to a sandy desert, is not supported by a complete study of the nature of the bottom, nor would any such activities be generically permitted in any Southern California terrestrial desert. Let's start apply the same techniques onto the ocean. Let's look at it the same way as we do on land. And we go through the same thing as far as kelp and biogenic habitats. I know you're time sensitive today. We need to have that data so we can take a better look and see exactly what's going on out there. And again, we've requested this. We've done a public document information search on this. And, I mean, we've been asking for this data for well over a year and have not received it. And it's interesting because, you know, you see it in this presentation. Yep, we can't get it out of the department. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay.
Good morning, Dallas.
Good morning. I'm April Wakeman from United Anglers, presenting for Dallas Weaver. Okay. Which button?
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, science is clear. Decreases in species diversity, decreases in structure, increases in suspended solids. The number from the DFG used to be 144,000. I think it's now 155,000 in
right.
What Steve just presented. You're taking that away from the environment, taking away from one group to protect the environment. The reported yield was 10 pounds an hour at $6.50 a pound or $65 an hour. It's not a lot. I just filled my car with gas. Whew. We're talking about taking that away from one group. The bottom clear cut is about 25 acres an hour. So they're earning about $2.20 an acre clear cut. Are we going to lease the bottom at $2 an hour, an acre? Present prices for trawl caught halibut. This is, we went up and talked to the people. Dead, $5 a pound. Live quality one, $5.50 a pound. Live quality two, $7.50 a pound. We understand that it's divided about equally between quality one and quality two. However, if you look at hook and line live halibut, it's $10 a pound. It's better quality. There's obviously a premium. Aquaculture, this is Dallas, you get an even higher price. So looking at it, if the trawlers move to hook and line, they can get more for the same fish. higher quality fish. And that would provide an opportunity to use existing resources, and aquaculture is an option, and that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary Burke, followed by Mike McCorkle, followed by Jeff Hepp.
Commissioners, my name is Gary Burke. You know, there's a term that's been going around for the last 4 or 5 years, best available science. What is best available science? I'm not so sure what the definition is or how to use it anymore. Is it a guy who brings in a wheelbarrow full of weightlifting plates and says, picture this, here's the doors? Or is it pictures of trawling in the Gulf with shrimpers, different nets, different equipment, says, look, here's what we do? Or maybe it's powerful representative of environmental groups to come up here and just say, they haven't proved enough, close the areas. On the other hand, we have videos of actual trawling that we've done here in the areas, showing the doors, showing the nets that they glide over the top, the doors don't dig in. We've got a study done by two or three groups, collaborative together, to give you the facts. I don't see why there should be any more time wasted. There should be enough evidence in there that, and in my opinion, it shows that we minimize the bycatch compared to other fisheries. This is a real good age-old fishery that's sustainable, light nets. Don't, you know, the, compared to other fisheries like it, it's the bycatch is way less. We use large end mesh net of the bag, and things get to escape. Everything's alive, like they presented. 95% get thrown back alive. You know, bycatch is a term that can be defined in a bunch of different ways. Finally, I'd like to say about the impact. You know, I think there's 30 active permits. The other day I counted, I think in Santa Barbara they have 11 boats that do that. And that's more than a third of the active guys fish out of Santa Barbara. If you close any of those areas, it's going to be a major impact. And it's going to, it's, I think, the second biggest fishery in Santa Barbara Harbor. So please don't put us out of business. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Mike McCorkle.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, President Roberts.
Or I should say, good morning, neighbor.
I guess I'll start out saying I expected to see what I just saw this morning. And we stand by our study, and we feel that it was very accurate, done professionally by professional people in the halibut trawl grounds. One of the things that hasn't been brought up in any of this stuff is the economic performance of the from the buyer side. Where's the fish go from when we sell it, and how much money is it worth? You see that this area is worth X amount of dollars, and that's 1997. And one thing is that the area is worth quite a bit more now because the price of fish is quite a bit different than it was in 1997. As far as the fish catch, it's about the same. It holds steady every year. But the department's fishery economic performance analysis didn't look beyond the ex-special revenues. And they weren't really given the time to come up with that fact. So what I did is, I don't usually ask my buyer what he gets for his fish. That's his business. But I did. We sell to a fella called Light Fish Company. They're two Korean brothers. They provide us with excellent service. We have one other major buyer in Santa Barbara who's here today and would like to testify. And our buyer, Light Fish, sells to about 36 high-end sushi restaurants.
Mike, is that Light, L-I-G-H-T?
Pardon?
How do you spell Light Fish?
L-I-G-H-T.
Thank you.
He sells to 36 restaurants in the Los Angeles area. He averages about 1,000 pounds a week of live halibut that he sells to these sushi restaurants. He sells them for $10 a pound. He buys them from us from $5.50 to $7.50. He sells them for $10. In other words, if he buys a 5-pound fish. She sells it to them for $50. They sell it for $150. He sells to 5 supermarkets. He sells about 300 pounds a week on the average to the supermarkets. They retail that fish for $12 a pound. The sushi clients sell one piece of sushi for $2. It averages out to about $32 a pound for sushi halibut. That 1,000 pounds a week at $32 is $32,000 a week worth of on that end of the fishery, which is kind of amazing. Or you keep extrapolating up, it's 1,664,000 pounds a year retail value.
And that's just for light.
Just for light fish. He estimates there's 10 steady buyers, and when the bounce ball season starts, different guys pop out of the woodwork, and there's actually more. That's over $46,000 in annual retail business for each of the 36 different restaurants in the region. And these are small, family-owned sushi restaurants. They're not big, super chain restaurants. They're all small businesses, just like we are. The supermarkets sell for $12 a pound. That means each one could average 60 pounds a week, or he's going to make $720 a week. Retail sales over $37,000 annually, which amounts to $187,000 a year in that region that he sells to. The other buyers here today, and his clientele is actually higher than Light Fish Company. He buys more fish than Light Fish does, and he sells more fish, and he's going to talk to you about it. But basically, one buyer, our buyer, sells, it ends up about $1,900,000 a year total sales, which is pretty amazing out of this little amount of halibut that comes off our boat. So this is very important to all the people involved in it. Thank you.
I'm Jesus Avias, Jeff Hepp, Shante Roberts.
Good morning to everybody. My name is Jesus Aviles, and I'm a small business owner buying and selling local fresh fish throughout Southern California, operating under the name of MA Seafood. My father, Margarito Aviles, started this business in 2002. It took many years for him to build the clientele that we have now, or that we used to have. And after his accidental death in September of September 11th of 2006, I had to request a hardship discharge from the military. I was in the Navy, just to help my family out from the hardship that we were going through. After my father's accidental death, I believe Monterey was the Monterey Bay closure started after that. After the Monterey Bay closure, a lot of imported halibut from Korea, it's farm-raised, came into the market. We lost half of our clientele due to that Monterey Bay closure and the Korean farm-raised halibut being imported into the U.S. I continue to sell to about 20 restaurants and from L.A. County all throughout Orange County. And like Mike was saying, each of these businesses that I sell to is a family-owned restaurant. And each of these businesses have their employees. You know, it's about six families per restaurant that's going to be impacted by if any other closures exist. Like I said, my business is going to be further impacted if any other area is closed.
Right.
Like Mike was saying, a 5-pound halibut, I sell it for about $45. And the restaurant turns around and sells it for about $200 for that fish. Well, I mean, that's all I got to say. I'm really nervous. This is the first time I come up in front of people. And another thing is that...
Relax, it's fine.
Like he was saying, there's about another 10 buyers that consistently do the halibut distribution throughout the same areas that I do. Lightfish Company and MA Seafood Company are, like, I believe they're the two main ones around that area. And I sell about 2,000 pounds a week of halibut. And I buy it from $5.75 to $7 a pound, and I retail it for $9.50 a pound. So, I mean, I would like to say the value of the Korean halibut that comes in imported from Korea, it's that has a double the value in the market. It's about averages to $20 a pound to the market. So, I mean, they make less money. They actually lose money. One of my customers last month, you know, the bad weather. We had bad weather throughout the last month. He told me that they lost $5,000 that month because they had to use the Korean halibut. And I mean, that's all I got to say.
Thank you.
Questions?
No. Any questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Jeff Hepp, followed by Shante Roberts, followed by Jeff Schester.
Before you start, I apologize. I had to leave the room or I would explode. So, anyway, Jeff.
Commissioners, can you hear me there? Commissioners, my name is Jeff Epp. I trawl for halibut and the halibut trawl grounds. I'd like to talk about what has happened so far with the SB 1459 pertaining to fishery closures. Already closed are the pink shrimp beds in Northern California, the entire Monterey Bay in state waters, which reaches out 12 miles, not 3 miles like the rest of the coast. This took away 60% of my yearly income. Point Sur to Ragged Point, inside 3 miles, an area fished for over 30 years by what is now the last grounds fished trawlers, processors in Monterey. No reason given for this closure. In the next 2 years, we are looking at more closures from the Marine Life Management Act. If this goes the way it has, it will not be good for our fishery. I feel we are suffering enough from this poorly written bill and urge you not to support option one and let us continue to fish in our low volume, high value, sustainable, renewable halibut fishery. This fishery should be a model for the OPC's goal of fisheries in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hepp. Any questions? No.
Shante Roberts, followed by Jeff Schester, followed by Mick Cronin.
Hi, Shanti Roberts with Oceana. Good morning, commissioners and staff. We have a little presentation as well, I'll be doing part of this, and Jeff Schester will be doing the sort of the main science content of the review that we've done of the collaborative study that we received since the last commission meeting. So, you know, Oceana, of course, we've mentioned before, we were one of the original sponsors of this legislation, SB 1459, and we have worked for many years now on bottom trawling issues in several parts of the world, including the high seas and a lot in U.S. waters on both coasts. On the West Coast and in Alaskan waters as well, we've worked on the essential fish habitat process. And we actually worked with Mike McCorkle during that process and negotiated a lot of area to be left open in the Santa Barbara Channel in federal waters. Let's see if I can... Ah, great. This is a similar map to what you've seen before. On here, we've got the California halibut trawl grounds, of course, and the black hatched lines are EFH closures, where you're not allowed to bottom trawl in federal waters as well. So you can see from this that there is the negotiations left a lot of areas open in federal waters to trawling in this area. Of note as well on here is that, of course, the four areas we're talking about, A, B, C, and D, or 1, 2, 3, and 4 as they originally were, You know, do not close the entire area here. In fact, you've got something like 58% of the remaining open California halibut trawl grounds in green there that will remain open no matter what decision is made by the commission today. So we also worked with Mike McCorkle on SB 1459 and agreed to give his fishery a chance to prove that it does not cause habitat and ecosystem damage. So we certainly appreciate the efforts by him and his guys and the Department of Fish and Game to try and answer these questions. We spent considerable time reviewing the collaborative study since we received it after the last commission. And we now think it needs to be reviewed by independent experts before any findings be made. And we, the Ocean Conservancy and NRDC, sent in a letter recommending this. To that end, we have had an initial collaboration with Professor James Lindholm at CSUMB, who has many years of expertise on figuring out how to measure impacts from trawling on all types of habitats, including soft sediment. Critically, he has found flaws in both the conclusions and study design of the research done to date. As a quick overview of our findings, just listed up here on the screen, the existing scientific literature is clear, of course, that the bottom trawling has high bycatch and adversely impacts bottom habitats, including soft sediment habitats. The collaborative study is flawed in its design, lack of statistics and unfounded conclusions, and would not survive scientific peer review. Even if we do believe the results of the bycatch study, they still show a rate for these areas of 73%, or 61% if you're just looking at discards, which can by no reasonable standard be considered minimized for any area of the study. The Department of Fish and Game report also states that no scientific study has been completed on the habitat impacts of halibut trawling on the CHTG, which is reason alone, really, to suggest that that finding cannot be made, that there's likely no damage to habitat. The videos also, we've seen those, of course, at the last commission meeting, are inadequate to show that the impacts documented from trawling in soft sediment in previous studies are not occurring. So we're concerned that a finding at this point would set a dangerous precedent that under California's statute, fisheries that throw away more than they keep are considered to be minimizing bycatch, and that it is not necessary to do comprehensive and rigorous scientific study to come to the conclusion that a fishery is not likely causing habitat or other ecosystem harm. So we recommend at this point that the Commission does not make a finding, as we do not believe you have enough information to do so and meet the goals of SB 1459. So essentially that's the no action alternative as presented by Department earlier on. Jeff now will present a little bit more of the detail that we went into reviewing the collaborative study.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Jeff Shester, and I'm speaking on behalf of Oceana today. And I also want to mention that I'm currently finishing a PhD research dissertation studying the bycatch and habitat impacts of the California halibut trawl fishery, or the gillnet fishery, actually, in Baja California. And so I'm familiar with the way these sorts of studies are conducted. As you've seen before, the actual definition of bycatch, which was not used in the trawl study, but is actually from the Fish and Game, includes all species that are taken but are not the target of the fishery, and this includes discards, both alive and dead. And I understand that maybe that definition of bycatch may not be as relevant. So we also believe in looking at actually the number of discards. And these data are directly from the bycatch study, which you received at your last meeting. And essentially, we've broken this down by the four areas. And the bycatch rate in all the areas exceeds 100% of the halibut catch, and more is thrown away than kept in this fishery. The one area where the discard rate is a low 23% is the area that no trawling currently is happening now anyway. And we just wanted to point out that in deciding about what standard to use, essentially the bycatch or discard rate is going to should be a standard that the commission actually sets. The Seafood Watch program considers bycatch to be high if the quantity of bycatch is greater than 100% of targeted landings. Based on the data that's been presented, the rate here is 271%, actually. So that would be over twice as much as what is normally considered high. And I wanted to just also show a comparison to some other fisheries. Compared to fisheries in the U.S., the halibut trawl bycatch is actually more than five times the national average. And compared to fisheries globally, from the bycatch study, the discard rate is shown there in red. It's basically only comparable to shrimp trawling. And if you notice, even other demersal finfish trawls actually on the average throughout the world have less than 10% discard rate. And so basically, comparing this fishery to other fisheries worldwide, which I think is really important in the Commission's determination of what the standard for minimizing bycatch should be, it's really important to look at the context of which we're thinking about bycatch and discards. Finally, we wanted to point out from the DFG report that due to the relatively short durations used in the study, the live fish percentage may not accurately represent the discard survival rate of the fishery because basically the actual tows that are conducted are 2 to 3 times longer than the bycatch study tows. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, there is no study or mention of post-release mortality, which has been documented in fisheries all throughout the world and is something that I personally have studied in looking at injuries to fish. And even though they may still be alive when you throw them off the boat, you can see that they may just be floating at the surface and eaten by seabirds, etc. So without any study of this, there really is no evidence to use this in a finding. And secondly, I wanted to just discuss the damage to habitat question. And really, this comes from the National Academy of Sciences report. I've been working on the issue of trawling and actually studying trawl impacts since 2002. And the basis for the consensus on trawling is from this report, which talks about adverse impacts to physical habitat, biologic structure, habitat complexity, availability of organic matter and food webs, changes to species composition, reductions in biodiversity. These are the things that that a study on trawling impacts to habitat is going to need to dispute in order to provide evidence that these are not occurring, because this is the scientific consensus. And even in soft sediments, I wanted to really highlight there's four basic types of impacts that we're going to expect. These are the four types of damage that we're going to need to look at when we're looking at some of these videos. And this is exactly what we've done in our analysis of the videos, which we've looked at extensively. The first is how much emergent fauna, such as anemones, sea pens, that are actually pulled out. People like to talk about, they come back very fast. But if they're removed at the same time where juvenile fish are recruiting to those habitats, that habitat is not going to be available. And that's where you can see actual impacts to fish populations. Secondly, the smoothing of bed forms, which are actually shapes such as sand waves on the seafloor, and it provides very important habitat for a variety of species. And trawling is known to smooth those bed forms out and actually remove that structure, which is something different than the way you want to look at trawling in hard bottom. Do we have the 9 minutes here, or
you have the 9 minutes for the both of you?
And total for the Oceana talk.
Okay, so is that...
So you need to summarize.
Okay. So finally... there's been evidence of this with juvenile fish using these sand waves. The impacts from other studies have shown that there are impacts in soft sediments, and as we said before, there hasn't been any scientific study. There also has not been any study of recovery. We know that Gorgonian corals, for example, take decades to centuries to recover, and the recovery times in this area are longer compared to other substrate types. Gorgonian corals are found in areas 1, 2, and 3, which are pointed out with those arrows, as well as a number of sea pens and other coral species known to be damaged by trawling. And we actually wanted to suggest and provide advice on future studies in this area. We actually have never been asked by the trawl industry to provide any input on the types of studies that would be sufficient to meet the burden of proof set out by the statute. And we don't want to suggest that there is no sort of there is no way they could ever meet the goals or the burden of proof set out by the law. We actually could have very concrete suggestions on the types of studies of chronic and acute trawl impacts that would include benthic sediment grabs, analysis of the bed forms both before and after trawling, community sampling using video, and actually doing a bite catch study that actually has significant statistical power, which the one from the report does not actually show at all. And finally, monitoring recovery over time. And so the current information really has not done what you need to do in order to show that there are no impacts to trawling in all the areas.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Soon to be Dr. Schuster.
Mark Cronin. Mick.
It's Mick.
It is Mick.
I know it's Mick.
Between your handwriting and my old eyes, it's, you know, kind of hard time. And then followed by Morgan.
Mick, he didn't ask me. It's good to see him.
It's good to see you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Mick Cronman. I'm Harbor Operations Manager for the City of Santa Barbara's Waterfront Department. I'm here today as a follow-up to the letter I sent you in November on this issue, which I'm sure you have in your files. And I began thinking about my testimony here today in concrete form a week ago Sunday when myself and many of my colleagues were doing battle with Mother Nature trying to protect lives and property down in Santa Barbara Harbor at the waterfront as a massive west swell sort of raked the Southern California coast. And when I was standing on the breakwater shooing people away, doing the best we could to keep the looky-loos from putting themselves in harm's way, it occurred to me, and especially the next day when we did our drives down the beach, the enormity of a natural event like that, that literally scoured the entire Southern California coast with a fetch that was so strong and so deep and generated so far into the Pacific, comparably to what you've seen in the reports, you've heard in testimony over the last year, the impacts or lack thereof to the seafloor from this small boat fishery, this small fleet of small boat fishery, really, quite frankly, in my professional opinion, differs by leagues of magnitude. And driving the beach the next day, we found uncovered shipwrecks, pierheads, pipelines, and things that haven't bared themselves for decades. And it's really literally boggles the intuitive mind to think that Mother Nature and the thousands and hundreds of thousands of tons of kelp it deposited on the beaches of Southern California can anyway be compared to the minimal impacts of the California halibut trawl grounds fishery. This, as you know, is a decades-old fishery. It's a fishery that's honored throughout our region. It's actually fishing in general in this fishery are offered certain privileges and protections in several local planning documents, including but not limited to our Harbor Master Plan and, I believe, in our local coastal plan as well. So what I'm here to ask you today is that when you're wrestling with the difficult calculus of this issue, and I know it is a difficult issue, and unless you really feel that you have compelling evidence telling you that this fishery is somehow out of hand or doing undue damage to the seafloor, that you remember what it means to the culture of our Santa Barbara community. This actually is a primary thread in the fabric of our social network in our community, in our coastal community. It's honored by our city. It's honored throughout the area along with our other fishing activities as being really the cornerstone of our working harbor. And our working harbor, the city council will tell you, has been something for which we have been very, very proud of for decades upon decades. And I can tell you without a doubt that if you ultimately decide in your wisdom after wrestling with this difficult issue that it's important to reduce this fishery, that it will have an irrevocable impact on the culture of the Santa Barbara community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Our final speaker on this agenda item is Morgan Castagnola.
Good morning, Commissioners. Morgan Castagnola. I want to talk to you about bycatch because I'm the one that did the study, okay? And let me see. First of all, we got
We can hear you.
We got rushed into doing this study, okay? So we had to go fish in areas where there isn't any fish that time of the year, you know? So if we go make a tow and we catch one little ounce of fish, but no halibut, that's 100% bycatch. So what do you do when you're fishing? Do you set back? No, you go find another spot with some fish, right? Well, in the study, we had to make four sets right there. No halibut, 5 pounds of bycatch, 100% bycatch, right? So that's how these studies work. Because it wasn't bycatch, we were looking to destroy the bottom, right? That's what we're supposed to be doing. So we had to go four tows no matter what, no matter if we caught any halibut or not. We had to make four tows in that spot. So if you caught, like the first day, they took home a Ziploc baggie full of bycatch. That was our bycatch for the day. It was a sandwich bag. But if we didn't catch any halibut, that's 100% bycatch. So I'm just saying that it's all smoke and mirrors with graphs, and you can do whatever. But if you fish and you catch a bunch of halibut, you can't even set back on that spot because you got to go to a different spot, a quarter mile inside, a quarter mile outside. Well, there might not be any halibut a quarter mile inside. So you go in there, you catch one bat ray, one crab. It's 100% bycatch. So I'm just letting you know that the poundage on the bycatch, it's not a big giant factory trawler, you know. We pull up one bat ray, one shark, which we can sell if we want, you know. But why not just let it live? But that's about all I have to say. Thank you,
Morgan. Any other questions? Any other?
Thank you. That's the final public speaker card for this item.
Okay. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, I had a couple questions for the department. I wanted a response on some of the information presented on bycatch, as well as I'd also... And there's second question here. The sort of mapping that the legislature looked at in 2004, was there any of this mapping available at that point in time? Did the legislature talk to the department? Because I noticed that some of the areas that were closed in 2005 actually are all sandy bottom, and from the mapping that's currently done, and I'm wondering what the legislature was looking at in that as far as the soft bottom impacts, if the department was asked to provide any information at that point in time.
Two-part answer. The first part, I think it'd be wise to have Steve Wirtz, who is in charge of conducting the study and can explain some of the information. On the second part, that was a legislative process, and we weren't necessarily directly involved in the negotiation. So there are members here who are clearly here during those negotiations that could better answer the second part than the department, unless Steve has some information I'm not aware of. So
okay. I'm more interested in how the state talked to the State Department about the mapping and the areas. So thank you.
Regarding that last question,
you need to identify yourself for the record.
Steve Wirtz, Department of Fish and Game State Fisheries Evaluation Project. When we first got formed this year, we're a brand new project. We looked into that exact question to figure out what we need to do and to begin our investigations. There were no maps provided. We contacted the legislative unit, and they said, "Oh, we'll talk to some of the NGOs like NRDC and some of the others. They have those maps." We contacted them. There were no maps. So we took it upon ourselves to actually create the maps that you've been seeing and other people have been piggybacking on to get an idea of where these closures are. Everyone was saying the halibut trawl grounds are all closing. The grounds are going to be completely closed. Well, we mapped it out and we said, no, if you read the code, it's not all the grounds. And then when we started getting bottom data and we plot it, we say, well, this is kind of crazy because exactly like you pointed out, Cindy, the northwestmost closure is all sand. That, and you're thinking, why would you close that one when you look at the other one? You go, this has a lot of rock. Why? This makes sense to me, okay? You don't want to be trawling over rock. Industry doesn't trawl over it because it's not beneficial with the gear. So we never were, as far as I know, consulted. And from my end, trying to find out the information to begin this process was not available. And we took it upon ourselves to move forward. Regarding the bycatch question, there's a little confusion. There were two reports made in February, and I think some people have been pulling information from one report and another report. But to straighten things out, to begin with, when we went out on the boat, we documented every single piece, living, dead organism that came on the boat, which is in our report.
But to make a comparison, because it says minimize bycatch, we said, well, how are we going to compare this? What are we going to do to show that maybe is it or is it not minimizing bycatch? And we said, what we need to do is look at the only available data, which is the West Coast Groundfish Observer Program data. They don't observe until this year, or in 2006, we have a restricted access program now. They weren't observing our boats. So what we did is we looked at their data, and what they did is they used trawl log data that went on the logbook. They said, we're targeting California halibut. So we narrowed it down to there. The report they produced, the National Marine Fisheries Service, it's only for trips that targeted halibut. The National Marine Fisheries Service is only concerned with federally managed groundfish species. So to make the comparison so you can see what the difference is, you have to compare apples to apples. So in our report, we list out every single thing that was brought on board, but when we did the comparison of catch to the groundfish program, we used exactly the species groups that they did. We didn't do it by species, like I've seen in some of the write-up from some of the other groups that have reported today. We used flatfish was one group, groundfish, and sharks and rays. And we compared across that way to make it the same. This morning, I think it was Mr. Raftikin, what he did is he took all the other information that we had that wasn't part of that comparison and added it on to those bycatch rates, which brought the bars up to say, hey, look, they're misleading you or hiding stuff. We were not. It's in the report. But like I said, to make a side-by-side comparison for you, we matched apples to apples. That's what's going on there in that with that question. Sorry if I rambled on too much, but did you?
No, impossible.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments?
You know, I think I have another question, but it might be more for Mr. McCorkle, if I could ask you a quick question on
Mike,
the gear type.
Mike, would you come back up?
We've seen quite a bit of testimony on some of the gear types that you've been using. About when did you start changing your gear type and making some of the modifications? Was that post this legislation?
I started fishing.
For the record, would you identify yourself?
I started fishing in the 12 rounds.
For the record, would you identify?
Mike McCorkle, yeah. Southern California Trawlers Association.
Thank you.
I started fishing in the trawl grounds when the trawl grounds were first developed. I was gill netting for halibut, and the seals were eating them all, and they weren't bothering trawlers, so I thought I better learn how to do this because I won't have any problem. Now they're eating all our fish. But anyway, so we started out, and I could see that the other trawlers who were older than I was at the time used a traditional gear that was different, heavier. And I thought, well, you know, there's got to be a better way. And we started experimenting. I'd say in the last 10 years, we've completely changed the type of gear that we have. And we're still looking for ways to change it to make it even better. So there's a big difference now than when it first started in the 70s, a big difference. And all the boats in our association, if they fish in Monterey or they fished in Santa Barbara, we use that type of gear. And it seems to work really good. And it's like Morgan said, they walked away with a Ziploc bag. They came with three shrimp baskets that hold 50 pounds. We said, what are you doing with those shrimp baskets? That's to take the bycatch back to the department. They went away with a Ziploc bag. They were shocked.
Thank you, Mike.
Any further questions or comments? Mr. Kellogg? Yes, I would hear a motion.
I would like to make a motion.
Yes, sir. For our way.
But first, I would just like to make a comment that here this commission is again faced with making a decision, and pretty much all of our decisions like this are tough decisions for us to make. And they end up being based on what we hear and what we believe from the testimony that we get. And over the years, prior to the rest of the commissioners that are sitting here today, I've made comments about doubting or having questions about some of the science that we've been presented with. And people who are connected with newspapers seem to always get my comments about science printed somehow. So you can print this one.
Uh-oh. I hope everyone's taking notes.
But it's amazing to me that the same people who live and die by science when it says what they want it to say question the science for the same reasons that I've questioned it in the past when it doesn't say what they want to say. I just will never understand that. So we're faced with what we believe and what science we want to believe, and then making a decision based on all the testimony and what we believe is the right thing to do. And I believe that the right thing to do is for this commission to choose option two. And my motion will say that we, in option two, which gives us the ability to choose some of the areas that the department has proposed. And in area A, we have 90%. In area C, we have 97%. And in area D, we have 100% of soft bottom. Area B is less than that, and this, all the testimony is shown that there's very little fishing in area B anyway. So with that being said, I make a motion that the Fish and Game Code, Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the provisions of Section 8495 of the Fish and Game Code, implement, interpret, or make specific sections of said code, hereby finds that the bottom trawl fishery for halibut minimizes bycatch, is likely not damaging seafloor habit, and is not adversely affecting ecosystem health, and is not impending reasonable restoration of kelp, coral, or other biogenic habitats in the following grounds: A, C, and D. The commission will consider adoption regulations to add sections 124, Title 14, CCR at its April meeting. And I need a second to that motion.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Do I hear discussion? No? Okay. Go for a roll call.
Roll call vote. Vice President Gustafson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kellogg?
Aye.
President Richard Rogers?
Aye.
Commissioner Mike Sutton?
No.
The motion passes.
And I wanted to make a few comments.
Explain what has happened. The only trawling ground now that is being rendered illegal by this motion is B, that A, C, and D are open and will remain open. Okay, now we have to proceed with findings.
Yeah, I was going to try to summarize the reasons for these findings and the reason for my vote, and I think where we're at as the commission. So I'm going to read some notes into the record. I think the commission has been diligent in its efforts to obtain the best available information about the halibut trawl fishery within the trawl grounds specified in Section 8495 of the Fish and Game Code. Included, which, by the way, I might add, is more than what the legislature had when they closed the grounds in 2005. Including this meeting, the commission has received public input on this matter and discussed it publicly at 7 meetings, duly noticed and held throughout the state during 2007 and 2008. And based upon the record, which includes written comments from the public, oral presentations provided by the department, and a diverse group of stakeholders at these meetings, The commission finds that the bottom trawl fishery for halibut minimizes the bycatch, is likely not damaging the seafloor habitat, and is not adversely affecting ecosystem health, and is not impeding reasonable restoration of kelp, coral, or other biogenic habitats. And specifically, the commission calls attention to the following factors related to each of the following grounds. And some of you have our packet, so you can read along with the table in this, but the grounds A is 90% soft bottom, 2% bycatch, and no kelp seen. Ground C is 97% soft bottom, 1% bycatch, and no kelp. And grounds D with 100% soft bottom, 8% bycatch, with no kelp evidenced. Therefore, the commission has determined that said designated grounds may remain open. The commission directs its staff to complete the rulemaking actions related to addition of Section 124, Title 14, halibut trawling within specifically identified areas.
Thank you. Any further commentary?
I'd like to.
Commissioner Sutton?
I'd like to explain my vote on this case. If you step back a moment from this, the present case before us, there's a general worldwide trend toward giving preference to more selective fishing gear and methods. Trawling, bottom trawling in particular, is presumed to be, and certainly in this case, presumed by the legislature to be a destructive method of fishing. Now, that presumption can be rebutted under certain circumstances, and the legislature in this case spelled out those circumstances under which we can rebut that presumption that bottom trawling is a destructive method of fishing. The problem in this case for me is that the bar set by the legislature in this bill is high, very high, perhaps impossibly so. There may be some forms of bottom trawling that are that will meet this standard, but I cannot in good conscience make the finding in the present case. We don't know enough. These studies are useful but incomplete, it seems to me. I would certainly favor, and I think some of my fellow commissioners may agree here, making findings on a specific scale rather than a blanket finding, and I'm glad to see that we've done that in this case, and I certainly respect the decision taken by the commission and the positions of my fellow commissioners. I would go further and find ways to mandate more environmentally friendly and less destructive methods of trawling. I know, for example, the Nature Conservancy in Morro Bay is experimenting with some of the fishing community there out in federal waters with less destructive trawl gear and methods of trawling, and those are very promising approaches. I'd like to see more of that, and maybe we can help make that happen in this case.
As for my commentary, and we're going to be going to our confirmation of the findings here in just a moment, but I haven't said anything. And I need to do that. I agree, actually, and this is going to perhaps sound odd to many of you, but not if you know me. I agree with all of my fellow commissioners. Commissioner Sutton raises some very fine points. I personally was not persuaded by scientific evidence that is evidence that was been accumulated globally or worldwide. When you're protecting habitat, you want to protect a specific patch of ground. And I was convinced by the scientific information that was demonstrated that was specific to these trawling grounds and these grounds only that there was no damage. I think it's very important if this decision is to send some messages, at least from my perspective, is that I don't want to hear about global this and global that. What they're doing on the East Coast to the bluefin tuna, or what they're doing, you know, off Sri Lanka to something else, or in the Gulf of Mexico to something else seen from a satellite, is virtually, absolutely irrelevant to decisions made on fisheries in California. It is disrespectful of all of the efforts of the department, this commission, and all of the good people out there who are trying to do the right thing. I believe that this fishery is trying to do the right thing and, in fact,
has done the right thing. So now, and we need to call for a question on the, John?
Staff has a suggested motion to approve the findings that were read into the record by Commissioner Gustafson.
Do I hear that motion?
I so move.
Do I hear a second? All those in favor? Aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Is there an A? There's an A. Okay. Passes. I think we're done for this. I think why don't we take about a 15-minute break?
Actually, I think we had one more item to...
We do?
Well, I think we were going to talk a little bit.
Yes, I'm sorry. Commissioner Gustafson, at your pleasure, commissioners, if you would like to consider possible regulatory action on gear types in the future... Commissioner Gustafson has...
Good point. Let's button this up entirely.
Thank you. I'll let Mr. Sutton take the lead on this, but I don't disagree, Commissioner Sutton, with your concern about the gear types. I obviously disagree with your concern that this was destructive in this area, but I am willing, and I have been very convinced by the trawlers that the gear types they're using are very positive. And would support regulatory changes there.
Mr. Sutton?
I want to make a motion, and just before I do that, we all have an interest in preserving sustainable fisheries and the communities they support along the California coast. Seems to me the best way to do that is to look to the future rather than trying to simply preserve the past or the status quo. And in so doing, we have to remember that healthy ecosystems yield a lot more to all of us, including seafood. And therefore, fisheries and fishing gear types that promote healthier ecosystems are what we ought to look to for the future. There may be many ways to catch halibut. I don't know. Perhaps trawling is the best way to catch them. But we have to find ways that do not unduly damage habitat. And I think that's a nationwide and certainly worldwide trend in fisheries. So I'd like to make a motion that the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the provisions of Section 8495 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific sections of said code, hereby authorizes its staff to publish notice of commission intent to amend Title 14 California Code of Regulations regarding halibut trawl gear.
John Fisher, you have a comment?
I'll second that.
Go ahead.
That's fine. I just wanted to clarify for everybody listening that this would be a separate rulemaking package from the package dealing with Section 124.
Yes, this had nothing to do with the action
mentioned before.
We'll
complete Section 124 as directed by you, and then this will be a separate rulemaking package if you elect.
I have a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Unanimous. Now may we go for a 15-minute break? Thank you. Fire away, John.
We have a person who was not available to be here yesterday who asked to make a few comments under public forum, so we're going to backtrack just for a second. Mr. Bob Strickland has a few comments to make to the commission.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Bob Strickland. I'm the past president of United Anglers of California. I've retired due to health problems. I have a problem that I'm probably going to stick my foot in it right now, and that's the abalone card. The abalone card is a great idea, but I think what's missing is an age limit on the card. And what I mean by that is when a father can go in the water and bring back the abalone to his two-year-old son who has a card and give him the abalone and then go back and get his three abalone, that's poaching. I don't care what you say. We don't have that amount of abalone to be able to give it away to young children who can't get the abalone themselves. I really think we need to put an age limit, 10, 12, whatever it takes, you know, to be able to have the person get their own abalone. And otherwise, to me, it's just more of the same, but legally. And, you know, the abalone is such a valuable commodity. And to see it just given away to children because they have a card is a bunch of bull.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Sunky, do you want to comment just about, for everyone's edification, as to how that all works, just so everyone understands?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. With the new abalone card, and as always been the case, anybody who takes, actually it's new, anybody who will be taking abalone this season has to have their own individual report card, which has 24 tags that are specific to that individual to when they acquire the tag. In this case of the father-son thing, you can still gift abalone, as you've always have, but when you gift it, it has to be gifted with your tag attached to the abalone to anyone you give it. So the big change, really, for this situation is before children could take abalone, father could gift them to their child. But now for a child to be taking abalone, they also have to have a report card themselves. Now this
with issue, their own.
Yes. Now this issue, a person has never been able to go get their three abalone, give them to their child, and then go back out and get three more in a day. That's illegal, always has been, and will continue to be so. So while I'm not entirely sure Mr. Strickland's concerned, that's, I think I'm trying to explain.
I think Bob actually raises an interesting point. You know, there is a point in a child's life when you're prior to that age, you really cannot physically die for an abalone. I mean, you just literally couldn't do that. And so if it is the case, which I think is Bob's point, that a five-year-old could own a tag, I know very well that a five-year-old physically could not take an abalone. So that would be an interesting... And right now there is no minimum age limit.
No.
Is there?
No.
So a one-year-old could have 24 tags. I think that's really what Bob's getting at.
Well, and with the new tag system, the only way dad can gift any to the child is if he uses
with his own tag. See, the only way they're going to get caught is the warden looks at the child, the 2-year-old child's tag sitting on this abalone, and goes,
"Might uh-huh. cause for concern that
yeah.
something's fishy."
Well, but or Abby.
Abby, yes.
But then he raises an interesting point. So that's one thing, perhaps we ought to look into when rulemaking time comes, is some threshold where we know that physically. If someone used a tag at that age, it's poaching.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize another big part here is we will learn a lot about the behavior of the fishery from this new system.
And yeah,
so
because of the
right now we have no idea what kids are doing relative to this fishery. We
Perfect.
Will now know a lot more after this is
Thank
in
you.
Place.
Any questions? No. Go ahead, John.
If you want to make a comment, put in the speaker card, please. We're also now going to backtrack to yesterday on one item. This is Deputy Director, Chief of All the Wardens, Grand Poobah, Nancy Foley, to give her enforcement update. She was otherwise detained yesterday, and we'd like to hear from her today.
I trust, in deference to your grand poobah introduction, you're going to explain what those dogs did to you as you were licensing them.
Yes. And I also have some other names for Mr. Carlson's title, but I won't be saying those right now. Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. Well, I was missing yesterday because we had a 3-day training in Napa with half of the game wardens in the state of California. And on Wednesday, we were able to do our award ceremony, and I just wanted to run over the names of some of the award nominees and recipients. Operation Alicia was an operation that resulted in the detection and eradication and reclamation of over 65 illegal marijuana grow complexes, destruction of over 300,000 marijuana plants valued at over $1.8 billion, and the actions taken to rid Shasta County of dangerous counter narco terrorists. And our game wardens participated in that because we're the experts in the woods. And the wardens that received some certificates of appreciation from Shasta County Sheriff for Warden Matthew Shanley, Warden John Dawson, who's now retired, Warden Mitchell Carlson, Warden Dwayne Little, and Warden Brian Boyd. And they were, again, they were all recognized by their peers for their expertise in the woods on that operation. We gave out three life-saving awards. One was to Warden Pilot Robert Morgan. He was flying. We had a missing person who was a federal trapper. We heard about it. They asked for our assistance. We knew that the federal trapper was using dogs. I think they were looking for running lions on that date. And so we put Bob Morgan up in the air, even though it was inclement weather. And he turned on some radio receivers and was able to locate the trapper and then call in a CHP helicopter to actually come in and pick him up. But without Bob Morgan being able to fly that day, the trapper had been out for over 24 hours. So it was a good job by Bob Morgan. Warden Lorraine Doyle also received a life-saving award for having the local knowledge of the area when a female hiker was missing for, again, 24-hour period when she went out for a walk with her dog, no shoes on, and was missing for 24 hours. Lorraine's expertise in that area led her to an area where she thought the hiker might come out, and sure enough, she found the hiker and her dog. So that was the reason for Lorraine's life-saving award. And then Warden Brian Gallagher was involved in an incident as a backup unit for one of the rural counties, I think it was Modoc County Sheriff's Department, when they had a person that was semi-suicidal or was looking for suicide by cop, and Warden Gallagher was in a fight with this person, and the person had tremendous strength that day, ripped out barbed wire through rocks. In the end, they found out that he had over three times the legal limit of alcohol in his system. They were in a fight. The person ended up being subdued by Brian Gallagher and the sheriff, and then went through some trauma to his own body, and the suspect had a heart attack, and Warden Gallagher and the sheriff were able to revive him. So for that, they were given the life-saving award, even though they had been in a fight for their own lives just a second before they turned around and saved this person's life. And we had two Distinguished Service Awards, one to Travis Buick, and one to Scott Bringman, both out of Southern California. They were working the Ocean Beach Pier area in San Diego County. It's an area famous to all game wardens because people poach lobsters off of that pier all year round. When they were walking onto the pier, they heard shouts from below that somebody was in a knife fight. Both of them ran down and were trying to break up the knife fight. They did see one suspect repeatedly stabbing another. They were able to subdue the suspect that was stabbing the other, put him in handcuffs, called for backup, tried to give some life-saving measures to the person that had been stabbed multiple times by this individual. There was a group around Ocean Beach Pier, which there usually is some kind of a group around Ocean Beach Pier. They started coming in on the wardens and harassing everybody, and so the wardens had to do three things at once. They had a suspect in handcuffs. They were trying to do life-saving measures on the person that had been stabbed multiple times and keeping crowd control until they had backup arrive. So for that, the person did actually die later, but they were able to get the suspect and save everybody else from coming in on them. So they got the Distinguished Service Award. And then finally, there was a Medal of Valor Award also given to Warden Frank Malazzo. He was involved in this suicide by cop incident, and he was able to talk the person down out of repeatedly holding a cocked revolver both to the suspect's own head and pointing it in the direction of the officers. But Warden Malazzo was able to de-escalate the situation along with the sheriff's deputies until some less than lethal ammunition was brought up and they were able to subdue the suspect. So for that, Warden Frank Malazzo was not only honored by our department for the Medal of Valor, but also by the governor for the Medal of Valor. And then last, but somebody that I'd like to bring before you at maybe the next commission meeting is our Officer of the Year, and that was Warden Kyle Kroll. And so before I go into a long discussion of all of the attributes of Warden Kroll, I'd like to do that at another meeting where Warden Kroll can actually be here. So those were our awards that we were given out. I also had the opportunity to recognize our first K-9 graduates. There were seven. We have one dual-purpose dog, which is a typical police service protection dog and a detection dog, so they provide both services, and then six other detection dogs, one of which you saw today and most everybody fell in love with. That was a badging ceremony that we did on Wednesday, and it was a highlight of my career, certainly. I had a canine companion dog through most of my career, and had she lived longer, I don't know if I would have actually promoted, because she was a great dog and a great partner throughout my career. So it gives me great pleasure to bring that program back to the department and give the wardens another tool out in the field. But as I put their collars on them that had the badges on them, I had to kneel down, of course, to give the dogs their badges, and I got plenty of kisses from the dogs along the way. So I know those pictures are out there somewhere, and yeah. I couldn't even see to buckle the buckles on the other end because the dogs were giving me so much love and attention. Now, it could have been because when they actually graduated, I brought them each a big box of milk bones and raw hides, and they may have remembered that, but that's beside the point. But that's the update I have on the wardens themselves. We do have a little bit of disturbing news about the sturgeon poaching that's going on in the Sacramento River. In less than a week, we saw one specific group take a 72-inch oversized fish, untagged, brought it up on the bank, and took it away. We hope to see the sales from that. There were some complicating issues. Then the next week, some of these people already have stay-away orders from the river. The next week, they took an 86-inch sturgeon and brought it up on the bank. The wardens were able to converge on the suspect, tried to save the sturgeon by taking it immediately from the suspects, putting it in another vehicle, taking it down and putting it in the water. The warden stayed in the water with that fish for over an hour, trying to revive it, finally left it alone for a while, came back, and it had died. So they took it to the lab, the wildlife forensics lab, and opened her up, and she was full of ripe eggs. And that's just really sad to me, what's happening up there. And one of the reasons that some of these people are repeat violators is because the Sacramento County courts right now have penalized them through fines and penalties, but we found out that these people haven't paid any of their fines or penalties from any of the operations that we've been going through. So we'll be working with the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office to see if we can't rectify that situation through violation of court orders or violation of probation. So we'll be working on that.
Thank you. Any questions?
Nancy, under federal law, commercialization of wildlife over certain value is a felony. That's not true in the state. It should be, in my view, and it would certainly address and make a more serious violation out of some of these poaching incidents, such as the sturgeon, where they're selling caviar and the meat. I look forward to working with you and the rest of the commission and our council to see if we can't get the legislature to do that. I realize there's a reluctance on the part of prosecutors and judges to convict people because our prison system's already full, but we have to figure out a way to make these more serious crimes against wildlife, because if we don't, it's just, and they continue to be simple misdemeanors. I don't think we're ever going to get a handle on this commercialization issue.
I agree. Thank you. Commissioner Kelly.
I just want to thank you and the organization, Nancy, for giving recognition to those wardens who deserved it. And I think I would be echoing my fellow commissioners when we say that you deserve a reward for being their leader. You're doing an awesome job since you've taken over that position, and we want to thank you for that as well.
I certainly second that remark, Nancy.
Oh,
well
thank
done.
You. Thank you
well
very
done.
Much.
Yeah. Or in the Navy, as we say, Bravo Zulu.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? No. John?
Thank you, Nancy. That moves us to item 13, the top of the agenda for today, announcement of results from executive session. Yesterday, the commission met in executive session under government code, pursuant to authority of government code section 11126, subsection A1 and E1, and there are no results to report from the executive session. And there are no public speaker cards.
Okay. Go ahead.
Item 14, receipt of public testimony on proposed addition of Section 355, Title 14, related to certification of non-lead ammunition and list of certified non-lead ammunition pursuant to provisions of AB 821. Please note the adoption hearing is scheduled for April 11th, 2008 in Bodega Bay. I have Deputy Director Mastrip as the giving a presentation or discussion on this.
Good morning, Commissioners. Just as a quick overview again, this rulemaking is about the last piece of implementing AB 821, which is the certification for ammunitions and projectiles. And as I've described earlier, we've presented you with a proposed rulemaking with a couple of options. One is whether the department actually selects and makes a list or whether the commission does. And again, we're here to hear public testimony. And if you have any questions, by all means, ask. Thank you.
Any questions? Go ahead, John. Do we have speakers?
Yes, we have a couple speaker cards. Ed Worley, followed by Walt Manziel.
Members of the Commission, Ed Worley with the National Rifle Association. I want to thank the Commission and the staff for doing the really good work on trying to implement this flawed concept. And just keep working with you guys, and we work forward to working with you and your enforcement staff to try to implement this in the best way we can and get public outreach so everybody understands what we're trying to do. But I also try to encourage the Commission that if you look at what's going on in Arizona on the Condor issue, I think it'd be wise for the Commission to task the staff with continuing to look at the science that's going on. Because the science, as we just talked about in the trawling issue, the science on the whole issue with condors and lead bullets is evolving and is maturing. The science is continuing to be done. It's not a static science. So I'd recommend the commission look into is having the staff continue to do research and looking at the science as it evolves so we can all come to a resolution to help protect the condors and help protect hunting in California. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Worley. Actually, we did do that. Mr. Mastrip knows, when we passed that, we suggested, I think it was February of 2009, wasn't it? I believe it is. Where
2009? You said February of 2009? Oh, you mean to come to them. I'm sorry, yes. I'm sorry, I didn't
screw up. I did say what I meant. February of 2009, we have a problem here. It's getting late in the day. February of 2009 to come back to us with commentary and with respect to what was going on in that thing.
Yeah, and I will, of course, remind the commissioner of something they already know. The statute does require us to annually review the lead exposure and stuff, and so our intent is to keep on top of the science and keep you updated as things develop. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mr. Worley, is his observation the science is evolving is absolutely correct.
Okay. Walt Manziel.
Walt Manziel, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association, President Rogers, members of the commission. We urge you to continue as you're doing to take the earliest possible action to approve those projectiles which meet the criteria in the NAVA bill and in the commission action. The earlier the better. We'll maximize the opportunity for hunters